Professor, you coined the term lavender linguistics. So can you tell us how you arrived at that designation and what it actually means?
A group of us in the 90s were trying to find a focal point or a site where we could come together to talk about the interests we had in lesbian or gay, bisexual, transgender language. And so we decided, frankly, the best sense of Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney tradition, we said, why don't we just have our own show, you know? So we said, let's create a conference where we can get together. And so we did at American University here in Washington, D.C. in 1993 as part of the National March on Washington that spring. And out of that came what is now an ongoing conference, and this will be our 20th year. At that time, we didn't want to call it just gay or just gay and lesbian because we didn't want to pin this interest down to any particular kind of identity, any particular kind of class position, or any particular kind of social location. We knew the general concern was finding ways to understand persons who weren't heterosexual. And that's a pretty broad category. And that's what we've tried to do over the years, is maintain that very, very broad kind of non-normative focus, or what's now called perhaps accurately queer focus.
I guess part of my question, though, too, is who makes up the rules about what gay sounds like? Is that what the conferences do and make sort of determinations about what is or isn't that sound? Who decides?
Oh, I wish we had that much power. No. Who decides? Well, the interesting thing about how gay sounds, or for that matter, how lesbian sounds, which is something that no one talks about very often, but the interesting thing about how gay sounds is that no one can actually pin down the gay sound. There's been a lot of scientific research, a lot of, you know, really significant work on this topic. People have some ideas of some of the kinds of things that may, in certain circumstances, indicate the possibility that the person who's speaking might be same-sex identified. At the same time, you talk to any gay man on the street, and he will tell you, I know it when I hear it. And that's a really interesting property of language, that there's something affective, there's something emotional, there's something about the way people pull together all kinds of properties of language to be able to convey this message about who we are as people, and other folks pick up on it and other folks don't.
Let me ask you this, though, Professor. What part does pop culture play?
Media has a certain kind of gentle influence in helping people understand what to listen for and helping people understand how to speak or how to use language. And let me tell you where this is really important. Where this is really important is not so much in your big city. Where this is really important is in areas of the country where there aren't that many visible same-sex identified persons, and where people's contact with what it means to be gay or lesbian or bi or trans is through media, through what they see on broadcast television or cable TV, or now what people see through internet connection. And so in a very important way, people seek out these sources as a way of trying to find out, how do I talk? How do I name myself? What do I call myself? How do other people act? And these become scripts that people adopt and enact in daily life.
There's a television show that was called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Right.
And I recall looking at Fraser, and I don't know if you looked at the show, but his brother, who was Dr. Niles Fraser, was a guy who was, he had a very exacting speech pattern, and was teased by his dad about liking opera instead of sports. You know, that you're not really the masculine guy kind of thing.
Yes.
So language played a big part there.
Yes, it did. And one of the things that you know your television writer does is introduce certain little nuance into script, and directors and probably performers introduce certain little nuance into performance so that the person who's viewing the program is kept intrigued or guessing. Is he or isn't he?
This is the Front and Center Literacy Series. Our guest is William Leap, professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. Regarding the use of the word gay as an adjective that means something negative, as in and I've seen these spots on TV. That basketball move of yours was so gay. I don't know if you've seen these or not, but there's an NBA frequently aired public service TV spot that's called Think Before You Speak. And in it, they show examples of what not to say regarding the use of the word gay. So have you seen those? And what are your thoughts about that and the use of words that we're talking about now? Also, the word queer, which for a long time was used to offend, but now it's sort of kind of more as a self-identifying word in some cases.
Speaking as a linguist that's also involved in social intervention, the issue for me in this conversation is getting people to become aware of the word choice that they're making when they use the term gay or queer. So I know there's a campaign, we have it at our university, that encourages the complete outlawing of the word gay in a situation like, oh, that's so gay. What I try to do, particularly in the classroom, is not outlaw the usage, but to encourage the individual to think very carefully why it is he or she has made that word choice. I think that's the way in which we're going to start to see some really serious kinds of linguistic change, which, in a sense, you need. You need people to start realizing that gay is not, and lesbian and dyke and queer, like some of the other words we can think about that are also on that list, are not terms that should be trivialized and bandied about the way people often do in vernacular conversation.
But what if people who are part of that culture use those words among themselves and in public in the same, well, probably in a different fashion than people who are not in the culture do? But doesn't that encourage the use of the words?
Well, okay, this is going to produce a reaction from some parties, but I think you've identified the key point. If someone is part of a particular culture and chooses to use the word in a particular way, that's their code switch. Somebody who's not part of that culture is not part of that culture and isn't playing by the same rules. Just because a group of persons from one community use a linguistic term in a particular familiar way does not give me the right to use the term in that particular way. At one time, this was called politeness, recognizing that language use does have boundaries and that we should respect the language use of others and they should respect our own. But the idea that anybody can say anything produces an interesting kind of linguistic anarchy.
And finally, Professor, can you give us sort of a summation about the importance of the words we use and the effect that the words have on people?
Well, let me try this. Raymond Williams, a British cultural studies scholar, once said that a definition of language is, implicitly or explicitly, a definition of human beings in the world. So the way I talk about you is the way I define you. And if I talk about you enough, I'm developing a definition, a description, a categorization, a summary of who you are. And I think for me, that becomes a very compelling issue about word choice. And that's why, for me, paying attention to how language works and what language is and how I use language myself as a gay man, that puts that issue right into the foreground of what are my research interests.
As we wrap this up, we talked about pop culture a bit earlier and the part it plays. Can it also play a part in what you suggest in terms of being more aware of these words and perhaps approaching it differently?
Oh, certainly. You think about what could happen in an affirmative way if some of your television programming made a little bit of adjustment and modeled some alternative linguistic practice. In some ways, Will and Grace did that.
I've discovered a universe where your eggheadedness is celebrated and your feta cheese thighs are overlooked. It's the Gay Spelling Bee.
Gay Spelling Bee?
It's a real spelling bee with gay contestants and gay words. Like flounce, hydrangea, set designed by... Come on, I need coats.
Sorry, Jack, I'd love to, but my mom...
Gay word is daiquiri.
I quit.
There's been a lot of theoretical criticism for that program, but one of the things that it did was it also presented two models of gay men admittedly from a certain class background, but still two models of gay men using language in two very different kinds of ways. If you had more of that kind of programming, people get to hear and see alternatives. And the visibility and the audibility of alternative, it's what's going to produce meaningful social change in this case.
William Lee, professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today on Front and Center.
My pleasure. Thank you.